day. These lunchtime sessions we've been doing for a while now. Some of you may know the format, some of you may be new to it. Effectively, a very relaxed session, an opportunity for us to kick around some ideas on a set theme. This week, the theme is around safeguarding and data sharing in the context of safeguarding. But, you know, there's obviously time for any comments, questions, queries, concerns you might have, you know, as much our session as it is yours, really. So please do get involved with anything that comes up. However, I'm not on my own for this session. I am joined. We're back to full strength this week. Phil Brining and David Holmes. Good afternoon, chaps.
Good afternoon, Ollie. Good afternoon, yeah, everybody. You missed the fiasco last week, Friday, when we tried. Dave and I tried to do the session from the new office terrace. Roof of the office, sorry, but we couldn't get a Wi-Fi signal, so we had to scurry around the corridors back down to the office. That was quite entertaining.
A full-on fiasco as soon as I take a week off, dear.
Exactly, yeah, sorry about that.
So it's only long weekends from now on, Ollie, but anyway, welcome everybody.
Lovely stuff. Right, well, as some of you may know, we like to do a little bit of what's been in the news this week before we get stuck in. I thought we could maintain that for this week, chaps. I don't know what either of you have got. I've literally only gotten back this morning, so I've not had a chance to wrap my head around too much, but a couple of bits I've seen on the BBC of interest. I've seen that the platform which we'd heard rumblings about, which is effectively the kid-friendly Instagram, that apparently has now been put on pause due to some backlash and some concerns from parents and stakeholders as to how it's going ahead, which is interesting. One of the things I'd seen around this actually in some of the commentary I thought was a little bit odd, because some of the backlash, if you read the article, talks about the fact that, you know, we shouldn't even be doing this in the first place. But, you know, I'm not entirely convinced of that. I think probably one of the points made in it is that kids are already online, so why would you not be offering them a, you know, safer platform, a safer space to operate in? So I'm not entirely sure that just scrapping the whole thing is a particularly good idea, but that's just something of interest. And then another one, which I have to say I haven't had a time to look at properly, but I've seen as well that a recent ruling in the UK has said that, I mean, this is slightly tangential, I appreciate, but a recent ruling has said that artificial intelligence cannot hold patents or IP. So basically, it's really interesting, this, for those of you who are, you know, involved in this sort of thing or just interested, but basically saying that artificial intelligence is not capable of holding rights in law currently in the UK, and that extends to patents. So even if a piece of AI has come up with a particular design or system, then they're not entitled to patent it, which I thought was very, very interesting. I'm curious to see how it developed.
Yeah, I noticed that as well. So basically, AI can't invent things which are patentable, which are
exactly.
Yeah, it's sort of quite interesting.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. Interested to see how it develops. I don't know if either of you had any other news items you wanted to cover off this week before we get stuck in.
I have. I don't know how relevant it'll be to anybody on here, but I came across a video that Taylor Wessing Law Firm had put out, where they interviewed a guy from the ICO about the children's code. Here's the link in the chat. It's quite interesting. You have to kind of go through 10 minutes of Taylor Wessing selling themselves, and then there's an interesting piece from the ICO. But that led me to have a look back into the age-appropriate design stuff, and particularly the unanswered questions. In my mind, it hasn't been answered yet, or hadn't been answered yet, about how it affects schools. So again, if you're at any schools here and you want to know how the Age Appropriate Design Code of Practice affects you, then here is a link. So what the ICO is saying is that schools aren't, generally speaking, directly affected by the Age Appropriate Design Code of Practice or the Children's Code, but they do have a range of important responsibilities, including when they're selecting services to offer and provide or suggest to their students. So that again is worth looking at, because as I said before, I was on a working group with a load of people in the ICO around this months ago, maybe even a year ago, and I kept asking the question, you know, how does it affect schools? It was really unclear. Anyway, now they've clarified to some extent how it affects schools. So it's worth kind of having a look at that now and then factoring that into, you know, what you're going to do in terms of procuring ed tech solutions and, you know, reviewing those you've already got in place. So a couple of links there if you're in the education space and you're concerned about the Age Appropriate Design Code of Practice. That's all I saw, Ollie, to be honest.
No, lovely, very interesting. Dave, anything from you?
Only just something I'd recently shared on LinkedIn, just in relation to tech, really, and spy concerns fuel the market for more secure tech. And it's just kind of the ins and outs of, so it says in here that it compares smartphone to a beehive where third parties fly in and out to trade and misuse your data that's collected through the sensors on board. So it's quite interesting. It's something, it was published by the BBC and I've just reshared it on LinkedIn. I thought it was quite interesting to see how privacy is kind of working its way through the ranks. You've seen that with other people. We've certainly seen it with Apple. We've discussed it previously in relation to the measures Apple are taking and things. But it just seems to be merging more across technology companies now and maybe trying to use privacy as a commercial angle in order to say, why don't you buy our products because we're more secure or more respect your privacy more. So it's just to kind of shared it from an interesting point around privacy and privacy management, really.
Yeah, it's interesting that, because I mean we've always said, I think, and I'm happy to be correct on this, but we've pretty much always said that a lot of compliance, whether it's from a privacy perspective or more broadly from a security standpoint perspective, is fundamentally going to be driven by the supply chain, really. And part of that is going to be, you know, individuals who perhaps have security or privacy concerns and wanting those standards there in the products or services they're buying. And it ultimately becomes something desirable for these companies. So
For sure. And on that, without diverging too much, have you seen there was a big increase intake in Slack? Well, not Slack, sorry, what is it? Signal, was it? As a messaging app, as the alternative to WhatsApp, when WhatsApp hit the news about everything that WhatsApp's doing and things. And I think Signal was a new app that had come out claiming to be more secure. So again, just maybe monetizing. I'm not saying wrongly developing an app in order to be secure, but again, monetizing the elements there.
No, for sure. I mean, it makes perfect sense. I think ultimately, it's one of those things, I don't want to spend too much time on it really, but I think it's one of those things where perhaps the outcome being desirable in that capacity sort of outweighs the actual reasoning behind it, I suppose. It doesn't really matter if it's made out of purely, you know, commercial interest or a genuine concern for privacy or security, as long as the outcome is positive, or I would think.
Well, I think it's going to touch on everything without trying to go into, I'll leave you for the segue into talking about safeguarding, but it touches on a wider kind of ethical point of a moot point, not necessarily for today, but where you're looking at the use of technology, privacy, maintaining people's rights to privacy, but then having issues with either safeguarding, having issues with national security, and at what point is privacy good, and at what point is an overriding public interest needs to be weighed into the considerations.
No, for sure. Well, I'll tell you what, let's, without further ado, let's get just stuck into it.
Sorry, I've just put another link up, Ollie, as well. So one of the documents on the ICO's Children's Code Hub are some sample data protection impact assessments for various sectors. I've put a link up to the mobile gaming app, DPA. And what's, it's just interesting to look through, you know, that we're always very critical about some of the DPAs that we're asked to review for our for various people, because they just don't go deep enough, you know, they're superficial. Well, again, it's quite useful to read this because the ICO goes into quite some depth, possibly not enough, but quite some depth in these example DPAs, you know, and the way they've structured it is quite instructive to have a look through. So, I think it's worth looking at, you know, what we like reading these type of things just to get some feel for how the ICO approaches it.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for that, Phil. I think that's probably quite a useful place to start, because fundamentally, so we're talking safeguarding today, right? And ultimately, what are the main things we're going to be looking at? We're not looking at just safeguarding the whole. We're looking at data processing, data sharing in the context of safeguarding. So we're potentially talking about lawful grounds, fair and transparent processing, security, potentially, you know, conducting DPIAs, maybe, as you mentioned. What are some of the key things we're going to look at today? And also, I mean, broadly, if I can put the question to both of you, just for those of us who are perhaps less familiar, what do we actually mean by safeguarding?
Yeah, just as I've just noticed in the chat, one person saying they can't see the links I've put up. So if you can't see them, I must have done something wrong. Can you see them all in the meeting chat?
I can indeed. Maybe
Well, if you can't see them, Cherry, at the end, then let me know and we'll email them through or something.
Yeah, absolutely.
You might have to open the chat up. Sorry, Ollie, I interrupted you there.
No,
so what do you mean by safeguarding? You mean?
you take the floor, Phil.
Oh, me? Well, I, before we get into this, I have to say that there's possibly people on this session that are infinitely more experienced in safeguarding, processing involved in safeguarding than we are. So, you know, by all means, you know, dive in and, you know, get involved. But, you know, we did a quick, I did a quick review of Wikipedia, that fount of all knowledge. Safeguarding, it says, is a term used in the UK and Ireland to denote measures to protect health, well-being and human rights of individuals, which allow people, especially children, young people and vulnerable adults, to live free from abuse, harm and neglect. So I guess what we're talking about here is when we're processing personal data with the purpose of, or the intention to, you know, safeguard, i.e. to protect people who are potentially at risk, you know, to protect their health, protect their well-being, protect their rights, protect them from abuse, harm and neglect. So I think that's what we mean by safeguarding in this context, Ollie.
Okay, and I can see here on your plan that we're working from that you've expanded on that to take into account the six principles of safeguarding from the Social Care Institute for Excellence.
Again, there might be people here who might be able to expand on them infinitely more articulately than I can, but you know, the six principles of safeguarding according to the Social Care Institute for Excellence are empowerment. You know, people are being supported and encouraged to make their own decisions, prevention, you know, better take action before harm occurs, which, well, I think we should come back to that one, because you know that kind of preventive processing is interesting, isn't it? Proportionality is a third principle, you know, trying to take the least intrusive response. Again, that's going to be relevant to the discussion today. Protection, supporting, representing those in the greatest of needs. Fifth is partnership, sort of local solutions through services working with their communities. This is all about data sharing, presumably, and then accountability, which again is something that runs through both the GDPR and the bits of the Law Enforcement Directive. I know that some organizations have adopted these kind of what they call the five R's of safeguarding to kind of put it in a nutshell for all their staff. You know, recognize, respond, report, record, refer. So I think there's a lot. Why I highlighted that, Ollie, in my planning notes, briefing notes, was because a lot of that is about, you know, prevention is should we disclose this information? Is it likely to prevent something? You know, what is the risk? Proportionality, you know, is this processing proportional to the risk? And partnership, you know, that has to be about, you know, sharing data, disclosing data, receiving data. So I've highlighted it for those very reasons, really.
They're all quite interesting, really, from the Social Care Institute there, Phil. There's also another document that's been published by the government that individuals may be aware of, information sharing advice practitioners providing safeguarding services to children, young people, parents and carers. And it's something else I'll bring up a little bit more later on when I start looking at some examples with you guys. And in there, they've got principles as well, covering things like necessary and proportionate. So there's a link there with what you were mentioning there in the end, and that Social Care Institute for Excellence. But then we've got relevant, adequate, accurate, timely, secure, obviously with the transfer of the information there, and goes on to about when and how to share information and so on. So it's quite a useful guide as well, but it's interesting to see that the principles there by the government are kind of representative and similar, maybe not directly translating across to those by the social care, but you certainly adds value to the assessment there.
No, and I think what's interesting about that, and you both sort of touched on it already, but is that clearly when we're talking about some of these principles or some of these concepts around safeguarding, particularly potentially for us, where, you know, we're perhaps more privacy professionals than involved directly in safeguarding, but it becomes quite clear quite quickly how some of these principles are going to map against our obligations under data protection laws. So we talk about empowerment, maybe we talk about being informed, so maybe we talk about privacy information, transparency rights around that, articles 13 and 14, for instance. So I think there's a lot tied into that, and there's a lot we can talk about. I think probably the thing that we need to really drive home, but I'm sure everyone will be aware of this, is that fundamentally what we're talking about when we talk about safeguarding is an incredibly broad range of situations, of issues and of individuals. And obviously 90% of the time, if not in every instance, we're going to be talking about a higher degree of sensitivity, talking about children, young people, vulnerable adults, you know, things potentially around their specific vulnerabilities, whether that's a health condition, whether it's a learning disability, or any more sort of more flexible vulnerabilities in that regard. So it's probably important to drive that home before we continue, right?
Yeah, the other thing that struck me, Ollie, thinking about this, is the breadth of data that's involved in, again, I say that we've got some experience with mostly within our social housing clients of safeguarding issues. But, you know, in other scenarios, there's probably more types of data that, you know, are being processed for the purposes of safeguarding. So, you know, I don't know if it's a straight edge. You can say this is safeguarding processing and this isn't, you know, or whether I should imagine it's a very hazy, blurred line. And all sorts of bits of information, personal data, non-personal data, data that isn't personal data but becomes personal data because it's now being used for a different purpose. And therefore, you know, the area is probably going to be very, very complicated. So there's factual data, you know, data relating to health, for instance, information that we create and synthesize, such as records of behavior, opinions, predictive analysis, those types of things. And there's also, you know, some, you know, highly intrusive types of data we either obtain or create, you know, so early indicators, for instance, you know, that's potentially invisible processing, you know, that isn't recorded in the privacy notices, it isn't recorded in the ROPAs, but it arises out of an analysis of a set of data. You know, and ultimately, we're going to use all this information in this context to determine A, if somebody is at risk, and B, you know, how best to support them.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. One of the ones that sort of caught my attention in all of that is when we're talking about the sensitivity of the data involved, what I often find quite interesting in this context is that a lot of the time we might have particular, you know, instances of personal data where in and of themselves, the data processed isn't necessarily particularly sensitive, particularly intrusive, but obviously in the broader context, if you're talking, you mentioned like early indicators there, particularly, you know, we work with a number of schools, for instance, and sometimes, you know, the teaching staff might report something which could potentially be very benign, but is also potentially, you know, an early indicator of a vulnerability. So anything like a child's been falling asleep in class, or you know, they've gotten into a fight with another student, or a child has mentioned a visitor, a stranger to the home that they didn't know. Anything like that in theory could be, you know, completely benign and very low sensitivity. But obviously in context, you know, we've got to be more aware of that sort of thing. So I just thought that's something quite interesting.
For sure. And also adding to that, it may well be a buildup over time. So the early indicators may well be need spotting first, maybe rather benign, but it may be a picture of a time that emerges. So when you're looking at collecting, processing, using information, it's not necessarily going to be as clear cut as in, right, we've got somebody, the definitely a requirement for safeguarding. It may well be a picture that you're painting over time, and therefore there's going to be a lot more data being processed, a lot different requirements for retention around that information. And it may well be quite volumatic in places on depending on the nature of the concern and how long it takes to fully show itself.
We've also come across, I mean, it's a slight tangent here, but come across, and I'm sure everybody else has, safeguarding issues in relation to subject access requests. So, you know, somebody puts in a subject access request, and, you know, I remember one case in particular where it was pretty obvious, even with heavy red action, you know, that a particular individual had made some derogatory comments about the person making the subject access request. And in the context, we felt, and our client felt, that, you know, their physical well-being was at risk if the requester was provided with the information that they would deduce this information. So, you know, we applied a very, very heavy red action to whole swathes of text because of the concern about safeguarding of the third party. And of course, you know, I was saying this, and I did it the other day when I was doing a session on SARS earlier in the week, that, you know, there's two possible kind of worst case outcomes for SARS. One is that you get told by the ICO to release data you had, you know, unlawfully withheld, which is pretty easy. And the second outcome is you disclose something that results in somebody getting beaten up or worse. You know, so I would always prefer option one. You know, so you know, err on the side of caution. But it's in other areas and walks of data protection, compliance management, and data processing that safeguarding issues arise, as well as directly looking at, you know, is this child, for instance, you know, at risk at home.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah. No, you're absolutely right, and that's a very interesting one. I mean, beyond what you're saying there, I've been involved in cases where actually the records returned from a DSAR search are completely benign. They're just things around managing a particular tenant and their situation, but because of their very specific mental health conditions, anything at all, even just the volume of records, could cause them to spiral in theory and, you know, potentially self-harm or something like that. And I was working with one of our housing providers on this. And the thing that comes out of it, and I think the thing that's often quite frustrating, is that there is a potentially a real, and this is something we might get onto later, a real lack of guidance around how to apply some of these legal exemptions, particularly in relation to SARS, to this type of situation. But also, you know, we spent a lot of time looking at the serious harm test, which some of you may be aware of, but is notoriously difficult to apply. I mean, it's really not easy, when in theory, you know, it's a very useful tool to be able to use ultimately, you know, the instances you mentioned, Phil. But I tend to agree with you that, you know, take the prudent approach. The only thing I'd say in addition to that is that obviously if you are going to make that decision to perhaps consciously not comply in full, then obviously, you know, have a strong justification for that and document it ultimately so you can ensure your accountability. But yeah, I'm very much on the side with you on that front. Dave, did you want to jump in there?
Yeah, we've certainly seen quite a few bits and pieces around the harm test and the application of the harm test. And I would agree with you, whichever way you fall, I would think, well, ultimately you need to be able to make that decision, understand how the exemptions work, and we can certainly support you with that, but understand how the exemptions work and where you feel it applies, and then to document it and record your processes accordingly, because then you've got a thought process, you've got something to go back to should it ever be challenged in that sense. But ultimately it still comes back to when we're talking safeguarding and we're talking the information that we're collating and potentially giving access to, it's still trying to protect people from harm, isn't it? It's still got a very human element there. That seems to be a bit of a common theme for me at the moment, just talking about data protection and human elements. But this is kind of got quite, in some cases, very severe data protection requirements in that sense, whether it's disclosure to the individual or whether it's disclosure to others. We only have to look as far as, well, in the early 2000s, wasn't there? There was the kind of spate of cases like Baby P, Damilola Taylor, Victoria Columbia cases and things. And they highlight the some of the issues that we're talking about today, not just in relation to SARS and access to information from the individual, but also sharing information around agencies to help support understand, distinguish, identify safeguarding concerns and being able to have appropriate measures in place to protect those individuals.
With respect, chaps, we're jumping way ahead because we're talking about exemptions, but we haven't really said exemptions to what, you know, so... I think we should take a step back and start thinking about, you know, if I say this with great respect, you know, if we're talking about, you know, processing personal data for the purpose of safeguarding, what are we talking about? We're talking about applying access controls. Are we talking about what's the lawful grounds for actually processing? Are we talking about lawful basis for sharing? Are we talking about the obligations for fair, lawful transparency? You know, in terms of privacy information. So I think we should take a step back and start digging over some of that. I don't know if the audience might be ahead of us actually, rather than thinking exemptions to what, but I just want to make sure that we've got everybody on the right, you know, going through this at the right pace in the right order.
No,
no, you're absolutely right, Phil. And
it's just
slightly baffling that for once you're the one trying to keep us in check rather than rather than me having to do that. But no, you're absolutely right. Let's take it back a little bit, because ultimately, and this is something that you've pointed out in these notes we've got, is that when we talk about safeguarding, there's a vast amount of statute that interacts with it, which, you know, covers it. Children's Act, you know, Health and Safety at Work Act, Housing Act, you've even put down the Human Rights Act. There's all sorts. But broadly, ultimately, our concerns particularly are going to be around privacy, around data protection. And because one of the number one things we still hear as a misconception out of whether it's the media or the government or whoever, the layman, is that the GDPR is a blocker. It stops us from doing things. I think that's probably one of the key things we want to talk about, isn't it, today?
Yeah, and I'm interested to I don't know whether we've got privacy practitioners or safeguarding practitioners or a mixture of both on the session. And I'm hoping that the answer to the question, you know, do these two functions work in harmony, or is there a point of conflict between the privileged practitioners and the officers responsible for safeguarding? You know, I would have hoped that there's harmonious working and that privacy practitioners are looking for ways to enable data sharing rather than saying, oh, which I think my sense is that it's changed a lot over the last decade from, or you know, well, last 5 years, or you can't do that, to, yeah, let's find a way to do that. But again, I'm interested in people's views on you know, how that is when you're working in practice.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm with you on that. So
you also kind of really just asked the question that I was hoping to come on to, really, just in that, and just very briefly before we go back to the points you want to deliver there, is I was actually going to ask, has anything changed? And I'm not saying it hasn't, but has anything changed in relation to understanding data protection law, understanding privacy concerns? Because there's a report out by Lord Lamming back in 2008, 2009, following Baby P, where they said that data protection and privacy are still not very well understood by frontline staff or managers. And I wondered whether that was still the case and whether that's still hampering things, or actually whether we've progressed from that point some, what, 12, 13 years ago, and there is a better understanding, but there's still some difficulties in places.
Well, I think, again, anecdotally, my sense, Dave, is that everyone's talking about COVID, you know, and certainly the DCMS proposals to reform data protection law in the UK that was released a couple of weeks ago, suggesting that, you know, the pandemic highlighted the fact that data sharing can be undertaken, you know, rapidly and on scale or at scale, safely and for public interest purposes, like, you know, public health. So I don't know whether, you know, COVID has helped this. You know, a lot of people working remotely, a lot of people working in partnership. There's, you know, public health information, which ultimately is a collection of medical data of individuals, and a lot of data sharing going on, a lot of transferring data between hospitality venues, for instance, and NHS and the NHS app. So there's been an upsurge in data sharing, not necessarily for safeguarding purposes, but for public health management purposes, which is similar in a way. My reading of the DCMS paper is that their attitude towards that is changing, has changed, and they fully expect to reform the data protection law to loosen the rules around this, to make it much clearer when personal data can be shared and the special category personal data can be shared. So I'm hopeful that it's going to become a lot clearer in the next few years. But again, I might be looking through my renowned rose-tinted glasses on this.
Just playing devil's advocate there, though, is it becoming clearer because communications and publications are clear? Is it becoming clearer because people are being trained and advised of what the law is? And again, just when I was doing a little bit of research for this, there was a government, document on information sharing guidance back in 2008, which basically said, in relation to safeguarding and things, that a key factor in deciding whether to share or not around confidential information is based on necessity, proportionality, and effective contribution to preventing risk, and that public interest overrides confidentiality. And that was published back in 2008. So I'm wondering whether the awareness is actually people are being trained, or whether there's better communication around what's already there, supporting the fact that sharing can be done where there's safeguarding concerns. And just trying to get to the crux of the misunderstanding, whether it's a training issue, whether it's an awareness issue, whether it's the way documents are published and produced, or just not brought to the front.
Or maybe there's a third possibility as well, which is that public attitude towards, you know, data sharing is less rigorous than it was in 2008, you know, and maybe social media is and things like that are driving this expectation that data will be shared, data will be made available, and you might not be aware about it. So maybe public attitude is softening towards it as well.
Possibly, yeah, possibly. Anyway, we're going down a different track. Ollie was trying to bring us back before I jumped in there, Ollie. So yeah, I'll go back to Ollie. I just thought it was quite interesting just to look at possibly where some of the misunderstandings coming from in that sense.
No, that's absolutely fine, Dave. I mean, I also had some thoughts on that point, but I shall save them because otherwise we'll be here all day. As per usual, we won't actually get into the bulk of it. So broadly, again, to bring it back, we're talking about privacy laws fundamentally, right? And we're talking about the GDPR in the main. That's the big one that people know about. It's the one that people butt up against effectively, that people don't like, that people are afraid of, that all sorts. Although I do tend to agree with you, maybe public perceptions are changing on that front, but historically that's a lot of what we've heard. So what are some of the key obligations we're talking about here then, Charles? We're talking about, really, I think some of the main ones are going to be transparency, really, how we manage that, how we manage our obligations under both the transparency principle or the fair, lawful, transparent principle and articles 13 and 14, providing privacy information. And probably the other big one is going to be lawful basis, right? Where does it actually say in the law that we can handle this information, that we can share it, etc.? Potentially also some things around purposes for processing, but usually I'd think that's more clear cut. Are there any other of those obligations really that you both think we should talk about in this context?
My view is that there's probably more, but I think we should focus on those, the lawful basis for processing and the right to information, but probably the former, the lawful grounds for processing, which I don't know if you've got any thoughts, Dave, on Ollie's question, but I mean the wording of Article 9 of the GDPR, you know, processing of personal data revealing da-da-da-da-da-da shall be prohibited unless one of the other conditions applies, and a bunch of woolly conditions. Again, it's pretty strong in its language, isn't it? It starts off with a prohibition and then loosens it up with this list of conditions that might apply, which is where we start thinking, oh, crikey, we've got medical data, there's a prohibition on it, unless we can apply one of these things. And then you get into looking for what those conditions actually are. And, you know, again, if you're familiar with ploughing your way through the Data Protection Act, then that's actually fairly straightforward. But if you're not, it's just really hard, isn't it?
I was going to support that. I think we'll leave it with where the areas that Ollie's raised in order so we can jump into them in sufficient depth. But you're absolutely right. It's some of it, you try to read the GDPR, and the GDPR in my eyes is quite readable compared to the Data Protection Act. In that sense, you do need to be quite versed in understanding how to read English law, because sometimes the way it's produced doesn't support ease of understanding. But in essence, by the time you've bounced into the Data Protection Act to try and work out where things are, that can get quite complicated just with the way it's phrased and the way it's kind of produced. And also bearing in mind which part you're looking in as well, because let's not forget the Data Protection Act 18 does four different things, doesn't it? In that sense, we need to make sure that you're in the relevant part of the Data Protection Act 18. Otherwise, you could find yourself straying into other areas that may not be where the relevant bit of the law sits for your processing activity. So it's you've got to be mindful of where you are in the Act and understanding which bits you're reading before you can actually then try to understand what it is and then try to apply it.
Yeah, you're spot on, Dave. I still see a lot of private sector bodies quoting, is it part 3 that the DPA is Law Enforcement Directive?
It is.
And they'll quote bits under that, and I'm like, I'm sorry, guys, this just doesn't apply to you. This is law enforcement processing specifically. And I think whether it's an education point, I don't know. We can possibly get into that, but you know, there are still clearly issues there, and the fact that there's this confusion just doesn't help. I noticed in the chat Victoria makes a point which is very astute, which is sometimes practitioners can have a tendency to give police the whole case file rather than looking for proportionality, and you know, that's still something that we see all the time, and it doesn't help when potentially a body which you feel perhaps could or should know better, like law enforcement, isn't helping you through making those better decisions around proportionality, and they're just saying, well, give us everything because we can have it. It puts you in a more tricky position.
Victoria's other point about consent, again, is what I want to get into now, you know, about, you know, you don't need consent, you know, so if you don't need consent, you know, how do you legitimize the processing, which is exactly what we need to be talking about.
Well, let's dig into that now, because basically the premise is that under well Article 5.1 for starters, but then subsequently under Article 6 and 9, where you're processing personal data, you have to have a lawful basis, right? And you have to have your Article 6 basis, and where you're processing special category data, so health information or any of those other things which can often, you know, come into play where we're talking about vulnerabilities, you need an additional condition under Article 9. And this is where the confusion often comes in.
And
we
the
talk
other...
about, do we need consent? Sorry, Phil.
Yeah, the other fact, of course, is Article 10 GDPR, sorry for quoting all this law stuff, but Article 10 covers the processing of criminal convictions and offences data, which used to be special, well, sensitive personal data, and now isn't special category data. And again, this phraseology in here, you know, processing of personal data related to criminal convictions and offences, et cetera, is prohibited unless carried out under official authority or when the process is authorised by law. Again, it's hard. I think people find it hard to kind of then apply that to their own situation. You know, have I got official authority, and which law out of this plethora of safeguarding law can I rely on to give me that lawful basis for processing criminal conviction data?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I mean, this is another point, which is that a number, particularly of those Article 9 conditions, so for processing, for let's just call it sensitive data, just for the sake of it, but special category, you know, a lot of those conditions come with a caveat that you have to have an obligation in law or a right in law to be able to process that information, an actual statutory obligation. And the number of times you still see a business saying, well, I'm processing for, you know, in line with Article 9.2b, I've got an obligation under, you know, social security or law or whatever it might be. And then they just don't point to what that law is. They don't know what the law is. They just know that there's probably an obligation that exists. You know, there's a real disconnect there a lot of the time, and that's probably quite problematic, I'd have thought.
Mm.
So, again, to dial it back, so Article 6, lawful basis. I mean, we've already basically had the question in some form or another, consent. Do we actually need consent? I mean, we don't, but for the sake of argument, Phil, Dave, who wants to take that?
Let's take the easy option. You know, so safeguarding, you know, so somebody has had a medical emergency, they've had a heart attack and they're lying prone on the floor, you know, the ambulance rocks up and wants some information about the person. You know, what's the lawful basis for disclosing that information? You can't have consent in those circumstances. And if it's a medical situation like that, a life and death situation, then it's clearly vital interest. And vital interest is one of the six normal, you know, conditions for processing personal data, and also one for special category personal data. So that's the obvious one. You know, in those extreme circumstances, then, you know, you wouldn't and you shouldn't worry about, oh, I've got lawful grounds to disclose information to the ambulance service. And maybe I'm being a bit silly about it, but, you know, if you wanted to think it through and get your lawful grounds, then it's going to be vital interest, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. So similarly with the example of where if you needed to, and I know we don't, but let's just play the example that if you needed to get consent, well, there must be some occasions where trying to obtain consent would be prejudicial to the safeguarding concerns, in the sense that it might stop law enforcement agencies. It might be preventative in some cases where it might be an adult there might be a child in need or some welfare issues around a vulnerability in a child. And by trying to get, they may not be deemed to have consent, may not be deemed to have the capacity for consent. And even if they did have capacity for consent, that it could potentially jeopardise or hinder any kind of welfare provisions moving forward by, in essence, tipping them off that there's a concern.
Yeah. Lisa's point about vital interest is really very relevant. I want to pick up on that. So my understanding and experience of vital interest is it's only applicable in a, you know, life and death situation. So you can't use it as a just in case. And I have seen it on records of processing activities that, you know, we're processing it for personal data of, you know, tenant flags, for instance, to preserve the vital interest of the maintenance workers we send around to do their maintenance. That, in my opinion, vital interest isn't applicable in that circumstance because there is no life and death situation. It's a wrong use of lawful grounds. There are other lawful grounds that you know should be relied upon. But the difficulty here is that the GDPR is really vague and woolly. And to get into what those lawful grounds are, which is what we're trying to do now, we've only got 15 minutes left, you've got to look in the Data Protection Act at Section 10, I think. And then you've got to look in Schedule 1. And in Schedule 1, there's from memory, 36 different conditions that are set out where processing special category personal data and personal data relating to criminal conviction and offences is lawful. But you have to kind of meet those conditions. And the one that we're desperately trying to get to is Section 18 of Schedule 1 of the Data Protection Act for safeguarding people at risk. But again, you read through that and it's actually quite complicated to make sense of just the way that it's worded. And that's just unfortunately the way that English law is worded. So I went through this last week to try to kind of illustrate it. And I'm going to share my screen because I did it in people who are regular listeners here know I've got a very small brain and I like to see things visually to help me understand them. So I put together a flow chart to take you through all the various steps that Section 18 of Schedule 1 wants you to go through. So, you know, is the processing necessary for protecting an individual from harm and neglect is box one. And if it is, you know, and, you know, your DICE are documenting each case. So if you can see my screen here, hopefully you can. And then there's a critical point in Section 18. You know, is the data subject under 18 or over 18? And if it's over 18, you have to go through a risk analysis, which is four steps. Well, that's, is there a risk? Yeah, and then three steps. And I'll zoom in on those. But if the data subject is under 18, you don't have to go through that risk assessment. You go straight to, you know, is the data being processed without consent? If it's being processed with consent, then you can't rely on Section 18 because presumably explicit consent is a lawful grounds. But anyway, you are happy to kind of throw this out there and share it. So you kind of plod through this flow chart to determine whether Section 18 safeguarding for people at risk is applicable to the processing you want to do. Again, of course, you also do this in advance as part of your planning, so that you're not having to make it up on the spot as a situation arises. But this is what I find useful to do, is to, you know, pore over how the various sections of the Data Protection Act are worded and reorder them into some kind of decision tree, because otherwise you just get lost, don't you?
Yeah, yes. For sure. That's a really valuable piece of work there, Phil. I did look at it before, and you know, I've worked with this particular section on a number of occasions. In fact, the two of you may remember that I spent quite a bit of time working on quite a complex project for one of our housing clients relating to some support services they provided. And part of the issue there is that, you know, we wanted to rely on a legitimate interest potentially, and then we wanted to rely on this Section 18. But obviously a key part of Section 18 is that you can't get consent, as you mentioned there, for whatever reason that might be, whether it's not appropriate or whether it prejudices your safeguarding purposes.
Section 18 sets you out, you know, if you can't obtain consent, you know, why? Because in the circumstances, consent cannot be given by the data subject, i.e. they're unconscious, in, you know, being held hostage at knife point or whatever it might be. Or, you know, in the circumstances of control, that cannot reasonably be expected. Now, I some people might not like the wooliness of this language. I like it because what it gives us a lot of latitude as privacy practitioners, providing we can document each use case. You know, we can step through this, I feel, and make sensible decisions that support what we're trying to achieve. So the circumstances of why consent cannot be obtained are set out in Section 18, but again, they're buried and it's really hard to extract them and use them.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. The point I was going to get to is the flip side of that is that in the end, for our regular processing, we wanted to end up using consent, because then we could prove in instances effectively, if you like, that where there was a safeguarding issue, that we didn't have consent. And actually, you know, in the circumstances, maybe the one in particular that came back to us, this was in social housing, but in domestic violence cases or domestic abuse cases. And, you know, it's almost certainly not going to be appropriate to get a signed form from the victim of abuse to say that you can share my data with, you know, partner agencies. It's obviously not appropriate. So you have to use this condition. And this condition does work, but as you say, it's potentially a bit woolly for those who aren't familiar with it.
I think the other thing that you've drawn out, and I don't know if you want to pick it up on your flowchart as well, but the section that you're in does require an appropriate policy document. It is on your flowchart, therefore, when you get to the end result But I think for those who's listening in order for this section to work under the Data Protection 18, you do require an appropriate policy document when relying on the conditions in which part 18 sits.
Yeah, quite right. And again, part four of Schedule 1 tells you what an appropriate policy document is and what should be in it. This is one I wanted to ask you about, Dave. So box 12, the process is necessary for reasons. So you go through all this flow chart and you say, right, okay, we're good to go on this, but is the process necessary for reasons of substantial public interest? You know, again, I think it feels to me like it's an unnecessary, you know, hurdle to put in at the end, which is very vaguely worded. You know, but again, hopefully vaguely worded to work in our favour rather than being interpreted to be restrictive.
I would have said it's you've got words like substantial, so therefore you're kind of thinking, well, what's in the public interest and what's substantially in the public interest? But either way, I think you kind of it's certainly got latitude, like you said before, in order to use it. The Data Protection Act 18 certainly highlights some of the substantial public interest conditions, of which safeguarding is one of them in that sense. Likewise, it's quite a common kind of saying, isn't it, that what's in a public interest is not necessarily always what is of interest to the public. So you're looking at what's in a greater public good in that sense, and safeguarding individuals from harm, taking that kind of a care approach, making sure that if you've got a duty of care to individual, that it's being maintained and taken forward, especially where those individuals are either deemed or potentially considered vulnerable and in need of support.
Yeah, if I could just jump in on this quickly, I've got a couple of points in relation to this substantial public interest idea, and there are issues with it, to be honest. The first of which being that, and I'm happy to be corrected on this, but surely if the condition itself, if it's safeguarding, you know, children or individuals at risk, if that's a condition listed as a substantial public interest
exactly.
condition, surely it's a substantial public interest.
Yeah.
So that in and of itself makes it redundant. But then on top of that, actually, if you dig into the conditions for processing Article 10 data you mentioned before, Phil, and you go into the Schedules of Data Protection Act, you'll notice that where you're processing criminal conviction or offence data, you can rely on substantial public interest conditions, and it even exempts you from having a substantial public interest there. If you go and check it, there's a segment that says we extend the substantial public interest conditions to apply to the processing of criminal conviction or offence data, even if there isn't a substantial public interest. So my question is, what's the point in substantial public interest at a certain point if you're going to exempt
it
for that?
I felt the same. I felt you kind of going back round the circle thinking, well, I need to demonstrate. But you're quite right, you know, because this is classified as a substantial public interest. I would have thought that you'd say, again, you obviously got to, for accountability purposes, document it all. But I also felt like I might be in a revolving door.
It is right. I mean, the ICO has given some guidance on substantial public interest, haven't they? And they say it's got to be of real and of substance. So I don't know whether you think that adds anything or whether it detracts from the term substantial. But they're saying it's not enough to make vague or generic public interest arguments. You should be able to make specific arguments about the concrete wider benefits of your processing.
I mentioned this at the outset, Dave. I don't know if you were on that. I read through, which I haven't done for a while, the part three of the Data Protection Act, law enforcement processing, the bit that applies to law enforcement agencies. And I just wondered, again, I've never come across this myself. I wondered if anybody had come across it. Because the police law enforcement agencies aren't subject to the GDPR, because they're subject to part three of the Data Protection Act, which gives the police and law enforcement agencies different lawful bases for processing, different exemptions, different conditions, whether or not there was any ever conflict of, right, I can share data with the police but can't get it back, or they can share data with me but I can't share data with them. I just wondered if anybody had ever come across anything like that. Probably not. But
most likely I can't. I'm just trying to rack my brains whether I have, to be fair.
Yeah, it's a tricky one. Generally, the interactions that I have with the police on behalf of my clients is just, you know, we're leading an investigation. Can we have this, please? And I have to say, generally, you know, it's often a bit insufficient and a bit sort of casual. There's some that are obviously better than others. you know, they have a standardized form to go through and a process, but sometimes it is literally just an email of, you know, can you give me the tenant file for this particular person because we think they might be involved in some way. And you sort of go, really, is that your standard process? Yeah.
And actually I was interested to remind myself that Schedule H of the Data Protection Act are conditions for what they call sensitive processing, which is processing special category personal data under the GDPR. I don't know why they've got different terminology, but they have. And Section 4 of Schedule 8 is exactly the same as what we've just had a look at in the flow chart, Section 18 of Schedule 1. So the police have also got provision to share personal data of individuals at risk and children at risk for safeguarding purposes, providing those exact same conditions are met. So that was good to see that that is mirrored there. But what I think we're talking about here, and I'm not sure we're actually killing it off and getting to the point, is that, you know, you're in a housing association or a school or, you know, an NHS or medical environment or a voluntary group, and you have concerns about, you know, somebody, and you want to share those concerns and the personal data and the sensitive personal data and special category data, you know, around those concerns with other agencies. You know, what's stopping you doing that? Well, on the face of it, Article 9 says that that's kind of prohibited. But then we've got all these different exemptions within the Data Protection Act. And in the main, if it feels right and you can justify a strong case, then often it's the right thing to do. And the last thing the law, you know, again, one of the stated aims, which I rabbit on about all the time, about of the GDPR, and it is to enable the free flow of data, yes, within a framework, but this is about free flowing data. This is not about stopping important things happening, like agencies sharing data about vulnerable people, people at risk. The objective is to enable that to be shared, but within a controlled framework, such as limited access, limited retention, you know, and justifying a sensible basis for the processing. I've lost my thread now, Ollie, so thanks to you.
No, that's fine. I mean, you're absolutely right. And I think this is probably our bottom line to all of this, really. And I'm conscious that we've only really got 5 minutes, and I'm not entirely sure how we've already filled an hour.
Just about nothing.
No, I know. It's baffling. I think our bottom line clearly on all of this is, and you've put it here in all caps in the plan, is don't assume GDPR says no. Which, I mean, you're absolutely right. You know, what this is all about is enabling you within a statutory framework to make those decisions and just to do it in a way that, you know, the number one thing that I end up re-emphasizing when I deliver training is, you know, just take and I'm sure if the DCMS are listening, they can record this, take a common sense approach to these things. You know, as long as you, as you said, if it feels right, document your decision, have a justification. But if you can't point to the specific piece of statute that enables it, and we're talking about, you know, high risk situations, at a certain point, you just need to get on with it. You know, the law is there. The law does work. But, you know, you can't just say, oh, well, I can't do that because GDPR. And, you know, we still hear this
I would fully agree that with everything that's been said, my only advice would be if somebody, an organisation, a body, a person says you can't do that because of the GDPR or data protection, I would ask them to point out the relevant part of the law that actually states what they're quoting in that sense, because a lot of people says it can't be done because the law says so, until you say, well, which bit of the law says that? Can you direct me to it so I can, it doesn't have to necessarily be confrontational. Can you direct me to that bit so I can just review it? I just want to understand that part of the law and to test it. And that's normally where a lot of the arguments fall away, because people are claiming it can't be done, but they don't know which part of the law it sits in.
To what extent do you think, I've always been an advocate of recording requests for information and data sharing agreements in a log and a register, so you have a request for information, you either fulfil it or you refuse to fulfil it. I have refused a lot in the past on the basis that if that agency absolutely wants that information, then they'll get a court order and compel me to disclose it. But again, it all depends on the circumstance, doesn't it? And if you really do have major concerns for someone's safety, then you talked about relevant statute, Ollie. The relevant statute might be the Data Protection Act that enables you to do that sharing, rather than, you know, the Children and Social Work Act.
Yeah, you're right. I'll tell you just quickly one thing that baffles me, and I don't know if anyone on the call can sort of mirror what I'm saying here with this, but the thing that I often find odd, and I'm absolutely with you on that sometimes I just deny requests outright because I say, you know, it doesn't seem proportionate, it doesn't seem necessary. I'm not entirely sure, and this is the main one I'm getting at, why you're asking us in the first place. I have a number of housing clients, and the number of time, if anyone on the call is in housing and can attest to this, the number of times you get either law enforcement or just third party, you know, even private agencies coming to you and saying, oh, well, I need the tenant's bank details for whatever reason. Why are you asking the landlord? Go speak to the bank if you need bank details. There's this sort of, I don't know if this is something either of you have come across. But
I've come across.
Yeah, this weird sort of like centralization sometimes. Oh, we're going to go and ask this lot. And this is one of the number one points I put back to my clients in that situation is, are you really the most appropriate body to answer that question? You know, because it doesn't seem like it to me.
You're like a quasi Wikipedia, isn't it? I'm not quite sure to go to. I'll go to the housing association.
I'll tell you what, it used to be exactly the same when I worked in professional sport. It used to be exactly the same in professional sport. The police would come to, you know, the football clubs I've worked at for lots of information about fans, and even the you know, we used to have the police observation box was full of representatives from HMRC and from the police and from Interpol on occasions. This is at Everton, who were, you know, losing the CCTV cameras to see who was sat in particular seats and going and lifting them if they need to. I think Victoria has summarised what we've spent an hour waffling about. So she's saying it can be in your legitimate interest or those of a third party and in the substantial public interest, Article 9 and DPA Schedule 1, for you to comply with a request from authority like the police or, you know, another agency. You know, to disclose data. For the police, their authority to process is probably under Part 3, sort of law enforcement purposes. But in the main, again, you can knit these scenarios together, and it's perfectly lawful and acceptable to do it. You can't then you got to apply things like access control and retention and how you're going to get the data from in the first place. So Victoria sums it up, I think, particularly well there in about 10 words. So thank you, Victoria.
What we've managed to waffle on for an hour about, as you say. So I think that's.
I wanted to talk about. We got to jump off because we've got another session, but I wanted to talk. We've run out of time really on AI in safeguarding, but we haven't really got time, have we? Because she imagined this is something we're going to see. You know, predictive analysis predicting that somebody's at risk, and you know, that being a feature of the future.
It's a bit of a shame that we've run out of time because I actually work. One of my clients provide products which involve the use of AI and safeguard. Actually, it's all based on keystroke analysis and potentially escalating certain instances to a human reviewer to intervene. But unfortunately we've run out of time. As you say, we've got a dash because we've got a session right after this. But gents, any sort of closing thoughts on this before we wrap up?
My closing thoughts is reiterating what everything else is. What we've covered already, if I can get my words out, is in the fact that the law rarely says no. So if somebody says it can't happen, to challenge them on which part of the law it sits in. They may well be right. They might be hitting on a particular point that you've missed. But a lot of the time, people will say no. Very similar to health and safety laws, where they say you can't do health and safety laws until you ask which part of the law it sits in. And then they start to struggle to find it. So if people are saying no, just like I said, just challenge them to which part of the law. They may well be right. They may well be an education for yourself, or it may well just make the problem go away because they can't find it.
My thoughts are we should run another session on this and spend more time because I feel like we've flown through it and really scratched the surface. And Vicky is asking a really relevant question. So, you know, safeguarding isn't an immediate concern or immediate issue, you know, but you know, again, the law is structured for preventive purposes as well. So, you know, it's not just like I have a safeguarding issue or I haven't got a safeguarding issue. Oh, blimey, I have. You know, if you can use the data protection law to, you know, enable you to manage data and share data for preventive purposes, but of course that requires some good documentation. But I think we should probably calendarize something, and maybe a bit more of a surgery, and ask a few more people to come on and share some real life examples to really dig into, because I don't think we've done the subject justice, to be honest.
I think you're probably right, Phil. I think that's an excellent idea. So we'll look to get that scheduled in. We'll get a follow-up in. If you've got any questions, you know, there's no need to hold on to them. You can always reach out to us, support data protection people, with any you know, outstanding queries that you might have off the back of this. We can help you with those. But if not, yeah, we'll absolutely get another one booked in. But for now, we're going to have to call it a day, unfortunately. But nonetheless, thank you, Phil and Dave, for jumping on this with me. It's good to be back to full strength. Thank you to everyone for attending, whether you're brand new and you know, or a seasoned veteran. We hope you enjoyed this. We hope to see you all on the next one. We'll be back at the regular time next Friday, I believe, with another session. I assume that'll be a GDPR radio. So we hope to see you on that. And if not,
We could pick over this then.
Actually, yeah, we can pick over that week. Then. Yeah, it is a blank week. Yeah. So, hope to see you then. And until then, take care and have a lovely end to your week.
Perfect. Thanks, Ollie. Thanks, Dave. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, everybody. Take care now. Bye-bye.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Thanks, all. Take care. Bye now.